group of neighbors and former students of Northgate Elementary in North Seattle have launched a last-ditch effort to save this school, which was built in 1956, from being demolished. Our resident historian Felix Spinell is here to try to untangle a complicated story of historic preservation versus modern education. And Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, Northgate Elementary is going to be replaced with a new school. The fence went up around the big playfield last week where the new school will be built. They'll then demolish the old one, which was designed by noted Northwest architect Paul Theory in mid-century modern style. You know, you might remember he's the guy who designed what's now Climate Pledge Arena, those signature kind of roof line, and also said in the 1940s, hey, don't build the viaduct, build a tunnel under downtown instead. So a true visionary. Now, I heard about this from Shawn Hubbard. She went to Northgate Elementary back in the 50s, and her family has been in the neighborhood for more than 60 years.
I remember going to school there, how bright and airy. The windows are amazing. It's not a gloomy school by any means. It's got this quality of light in the hallways, and I just remember that viscerally as a kid, how great that was. The gigantic playfield was where we would all go and just have, you know, pick up games. And of course, four generations of my family have been on that field, and almost everyone in the neighborhood could say the same thing.
Now, Shawn Hubbard believes that the decision by Seattle Public Schools to demolish Northgate Elementary predates the public process that took place in 2020, and it misses an opportunity to renovate a community landmark for generations of students.
We don't know because it's not made public, the information, but apparently they had planned to demolish the school way back before the levee even existed. And we don't know. We don't know why they made the decision. They say that the school needs renovation. It can't be brought up to code. I doubt that's true because not too far from there is Cedar Park Elementary. That is also a Paul Theory designed school. And that was successfully saved and remodeled, and it's a great school today. Everyone's actually loves it.
Yeah, and in March last year, the Seattle Landmarks Preservation Board held a public meeting and voted to not nominate Northgate Elementary as a city landmark because it didn't meet the landmark standards. You know, funny thing, though, back in 2012, the Washington State Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation said the school was likely eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. And this fact was never mentioned in the public meeting or in the staff report a year ago. Now, in choosing to not add Northgate Elementary to the city register, Seattle Landmarks board members agreed with staff that it didn't meet key criteria. They said the school is not one of Theory's better works, and other better examples still exist, like Cedar Park. Now, Jeff Murdoch was at that meeting in March 2020. He works for the nonprofit advocacy group Historic Seattle, and he studied Paul Theory. He says you can't just pick and choose which examples of a great architect's work that you save.
Northgate School is really one chapter in the body of his work that tells like this investigation into concrete, different ways of expressing concrete architecture. And Cedar Park School is a beautiful work with a great expression of thin shell concrete. But, you know, Northgate School is a different type of concrete construction. So it really shows like his evolution and his kind of development as a practitioner.
You know, and these school preservation debates often bring out a lot of emotion, but listening to the audio from the Seattle Landmarks Preservation Board hearing from March 2020, this is right before the pandemic really kicked in, it seems like there's a little more to the discussion than just the merits of the school as a historic landmark. Now, this public meeting audio isn't great, but this is Linda Sinney. She's a teacher at Northgate Elementary who's also the parent of a student there.
I believe that it really comes down to where your values are. Do you value this white man who created this building 69 roughly years ago, that some people want a landmark but does not serve as a landmark for the people that are going to use it? Or do you value the education of a vulnerable, marginalized population of children?
Yeah, so she was saying the choice was essentially between preservation or marginalized kids. And Northgate Elementary, I think there's 74% of kids there are eligible for a reduced or free lunch against the state average of 43%. Now, hers wasn't the only comment about the social justice and equity argument in favor of tearing down the school. The principal said something similar, as did a number of other commenters. But as Landmark board member Manish Chalana pointed out, social justice criteria aren't part of the official preservation ordinance, and they don't really factor into decisions about designating landmarks.
What I'm saying is, this is not our job here is not to take care, you know, address equity. We cannot. And our job here is not to say, we could, but it's not our job.
You know, and of course, equity conversations are taking place everywhere, but this might be something relatively new in the field of historic preservation. I asked Jeff Murdoch of Historic Seattle if these social justice and equity issues are, in fact, coming up more in public meetings about landmarks.
Well, I think it's increasingly common and increasingly discussed, and it's not really part of the landmarks ordinance, but it should be. It should be a question of how we look at what's significant. You know, we have community members on the other side of the sort of social justice and equity question who are trying to preserve their sites, you know, that are important to them. And honestly, I felt like this building could have been adaptively reused or, you know, gone through a pretty serious rehabilitation and could have provided a great school that would sort of speak to the history of both the architecture as well as the history of the school itself. So we think preservation actually has a role in promoting this discussion.
Yeah, so they're not mutually exclusive then. You can have historic preservation and renovated or adaptively reused historic buildings and not be perpetuating inequities and injustice. It seems all kind of tangled up. Now, there's a related effort underway by 4Culture. That's the Countywide Arts and Heritage Agency. They have a project called Beyond Integrity. They're looking at equity and deciding what places to save. This is sort of more along the lines of Jeff Murdoch was talking about. There doesn't seem to be any real taking into account these discussions or the debate between, you know, preservation versus, you know, continuing to harm marginalized kids. Now, as for Northgate Elementary, we reached out to the school district late last Thursday, and because of the holiday, they've not been able to get back to us with any answers to our questions. There is a public hearing on Monday, June 14th, regarding some appeals that have been made related to the new construction, not to the historic preservation question. So there's still a chance that the project could be delayed, perhaps. But bottom line, if there's a school or other building in your neighborhood that you care about, it's really important to find out from the public agency that owns it if there's any plans in the works for it. And if you don't like those plans, you know, get involved and try to make a difference.
It sounds like what the parent in that earlier clip was saying was that we already honor plenty of white people who had an historic impact on the area. Why are we honoring one more white architect when, in fact, the neighborhood's changed and these kids need a better educational facility?
Yeah, that's exactly. And it's in some ways that sort of conflating two unrelated topics, where if that school could be preserved and you could have a nice school to serve the students who currently live there, you could accomplish both. I think that's what Jeff Murdoch was getting at. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the cutting edge of a really interesting conversation about what historic preservation means in terms of these equity questions. I mean, it's fascinating, really.
Felix Bunnell, all his interviews and features are available at mynorthwest.com. Felix, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
As we enter Pride Month, Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch looks at our charity of the month, the charity that's been helping LGBTQ families for decades.
Originally founded in the 1970s as parents and friends of lesbians and gays, the group PFLAG now includes loved ones of anyone in the LGBTQ community.
They were there for me when my kid came out as transgender.
Volunteer and Seattle board member Debbie Gordon.
PFLAG has educational booklets specifically about how to be an ally for the transgender community. And it even had a glossary of terms so I could look up different words that were brand new for me, like pansexual or asexual.
Beyond supplying information, Gordon says PFLAG offers support, providing families with a safe place to share.
A way for me to connect with other families who were on very similar paths as mine.
Because Gordon says the group's core mission is to keep families together.
What we have found is if someone in the LGBTQ community has at least one person, preferably a parent, supporting them, their odds of being successful, of being healthy, of thriving in life go up astronomically.
According to the crisis intervention group, the Trevor Project, same and bisex youth are nearly 5 times as likely to have attempted suicide compared to heterosexual youth. 40% of transgender adults have reported making a suicide attempt. For those who have family support,
they're more likely to survive, honestly.
Since its founding, PFLAG has become the largest network of support and advocacy for the LGBTQ community, with hundreds of chapters nationally and more than a dozen here in Washington State.
Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch. Question, why is it taking so long to start the spending on road projects and energy projects and broadband projects when there's widespread support for all those things and Democrats have control of the House and Senate? Here's the president's answer.
Well, because Biden only has a majority of effectively 4 votes in the House and a tie in the Senate. with two members of the Senate who vote more with my Republican friends.
Let's bring in CBS News political analyst Leonard Steinhorn. Leonard, is there a chance that yet again the whole infrastructure thing collapses?
Well, that's a good question, because the Democrats are determined to, you know, get an infrastructure bill through, and they will do it either in a compromise with the Republicans, though the two sides remain far apart, or they will try to go through what's called budget reconciliation, which is how they passed the last COVID stimulus bill, which only requires the 50 Democratic senators, because you can then use that to sort of circumvent a filibuster, because otherwise Mitch McConnell and the Republicans can filibuster whatever they wish, just as they did with that January 6th commission. So for Joe Biden, he's not only dealing with Mitch McConnell and the prospect of a filibuster if they try to bring this before the full Senate. He's also dealing with a couple of Democratic senators who are more hesitant to sort of stick with the team on this and pass it through budget reconciliation. So he has a bunch of different hills to climb. It just depends whether he can come to some sort of compromise with the Republicans in a bipartisan way that satisfies enough of his caucus to make them feel good, or whether they have to try and go through this reconciliation process.
Where are the Republicans at now for a number? They're at like $900 billion or something, right?
Yeah, so the Republicans started about, I don't know, $600 billion or so, and now they've raised it to close to $1 trillion. But Joe Biden started at $2.3 trillion and has lowered it to $1.7 trillion. So the question is whether they can meet in the middle. But it's not just the actual numbers, it's what the bill would include.
Right.
So does the bill include just what's called traditional infrastructure, roads, bridges, pipes, you know, even electrical grid? Or does it increase sort of the definition of infrastructure to include sort of human infrastructure, helping workers take care of their elderly parents or their children, child care and elder care, which is sort of a productivity-based form of infrastructure, according to Biden, as well as more climate-friendly infrastructure, which basically prepares our infrastructure for the climate challenges in the decades ahead. So Joe Biden is trying to expand the definition of infrastructure, saying that, look, we just can't think of infrastructure in the old ways of an industrial society. We have to look at it in terms of the 21st century and the challenges we face. So the two sides really disagree on that, because Joe Biden and the Democrats want a more expansive view of infrastructure, and the Republicans want to keep it based on the old traditional thing. Plus, they disagree over how to fund it. Joe Biden says you need to sort of raise taxes on the richest Americans and on corporations and sort of undo some of those tax cuts from 2017 that the Republicans and Donald Trump put in place. And the Republicans are basically saying, nope, don't want to do that. Let's redirect a lot of this money from the COVID relief programs that we've had in place, which the Democrats resist because that money they believe is essential to communities and small businesses and workers. So there's a difference in terms of the scope of the plan, as well as how to pay for it.
Okay, but instead of fighting over definitions, just pass what the Republicans are willing to pay for and come back for the rest, because a lot of the rest is going to directly affect their constituency, which, as far as I understand it, is still struggling economically. So you go ahead and get the roads and bridges fixed up, and then you ask, okay, now how about your own people who are having trouble paying their mortgages and making sure their kids get an education? How about we throw some money at that too? And then if they want to say, no, screw our constituency, they got an issue in 2022.
Yeah, but they also want to go big because they feel that that's what will brand the Joe Biden administration, is pumping a lot of money into the needs of American society.
But they can't go big, Leonard. They can't go big. They haven't got the votes for it, even in their own party. So you got to go somewhere. You can't go zero.
Point. Right. So the point is at a minimum, they can still go small by budget reconciliation. So if they can do that anyway without the Republican support, what they want to do is to try and go bigger to be able to bring in more of those programs that they like. So, you know, it's in all likelihood they will have an ability through budget reconciliation to go small if they so wish. But they also don't want to sort of starve some of the money that they believe has already been dedicated from COVID, which is what the Republicans want to do. They don't want to starve that money to be able to get this infrastructure bill passed through. So for the Democrats, they do have some cards in their hand that they can use on all of this. And that's why they're trying to, you know, sort of work with the Republicans and move them along in a certain direction. They may not be able to get everything they want if they go through budget reconciliation, but they may be able to get more of what they want through budget reconciliation than they would be through a bipartisan bill with the Republicans. So that's all of the factors that they're weighing right now. But there is a time clock on this because they want to get this passed sooner. From Joe Biden's perspective, he wants to get it passed sort of right now because he wants to move on to other aspects of his agenda. And he wants all of this money starting to spend very quickly because that will then filter through into the economy as 2022 hits. So, you know, and then the question is, are they talking with each other sort of like a kabuki dance? Is it all for show? Is it the appearance of bipartisanship is more important than bipartisanship? And you can say that potentially about Joe Biden as well as the Republicans. You know, each side wonders if the other is acting in good faith. But what the Democrats do have, that extra card they have in their hand, is the possibility of going through budget reconciliation. And even if it's not as big a plan as Joe Biden wants to be able to get sort of the Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinemas onto the bill, they can still probably go through budget reconciliation to get more of what they want than if they strike a bipartisan deal with the Republicans.
CBS News political analyst Leonard Steinhoid. Thanks, Leonard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan, and here comes Hannah Scott. King County is joining more than a dozen cities across the country in banning the use of facial recognition software by the county government. Chi Radio's Hannah Scott explains what the new rule will and will not do.
The proposal first floated weeks ago as more and more research emerges showing negative outcomes from the tech, such as misidentifying people that disproportionately impacts Black men, and has even led to some being wrongfully jailed. Many turned out to push for the ban at earlier hearings.
This technology poses unprecedented privacy, civil liberties, and equity concerns.
Who in a free society wants to have the only means of opting out of this surveillance is by never leaving one's home.
And the ACLU's Jennifer Lee was back for the push across the finish line yesterday.
Facial recognition technology is a powerful, privacy-invasive, and racially biased technology that gives the government unprecedented power to automatically identify, locate, and track people based on images of their faces. The dangers inherent in government use of this technology are immense, and use of these systems is not worth the risk.
She stressed,
while facial recognition is dangerous, whether or not it works accurately, it is important to recognize that this technology disproportionately misidentifies people of color, women, trans people, non-binary people, and young and elderly people, supercharging discrimination and putting vulnerable people at great risk of harm. These errors have had real-world impacts, including harassment, wrongful imprisonment, and may even lead to death in cases of violent police interactions.
Sponsor Jeannie Cole Wells explaining.
It is aimed to protect our residents' civil liberties and freedom from government surveillance, as well as, in very particular, to guard against racial disparities in the use of surveillance techniques. It includes all agencies of King County government, including Public Safety Department, the King County Sheriff's Office.
For her, the bottom line is,
make sure that we as the council are protecting the rights, the civil liberties, freedom from surveillance by the government in King County. And very specifically, as I mentioned before, to bring no harm to disproportionately to our most marginalized neighbors. And doing so, we will become the first county in the nation to implement such a ban.
And
we are in a situation in which technology in our lives is expanding exponentially. And I, for one, am very concerned about that and its usage that we may have no control over.
There was one small tweak proposed by Councilmember Claudia Balducci.
The idea here is, as I've said before when we've talked about this in committee. I do think that there are or could be beneficial uses of this technology, but that it requires safeguards. I believe that we're doing this in the correct order, which is to protect first, allow second. And that is because once you sort of allow the kind of database collection and activities that are needed to implement this, it'd be very, very hard to control it again later on. However, what this says is that if, say, one of our departments, I do not know which one, but one of them, one section of county government, decides there's a really important use that they want to use facial recognition for, they could bring that to our attention. They would have to provide the report that is required in state law that shows all the ways in which they comply with the more detailed requirements of state law, which would allow facial recognition. And at that point, the council would, if this amendment passed, be obligated to review the ordinance. What does review mean? Review means we have to discuss it. It does not mean we reopen it. It does not mean that anything is introduced or that we take a vote, although those things could happen.
Her point.
All the amendment does is require us to have a discussion. So it resurfaces the issue at a future date when there's some real reason why county government would like to use facial recognition.
And while she doubted its necessity, Colwell said,
I will support it. I don't think it's needed, but I will support it.
The rest of the council agreed. The amendment was added. On final passage of the full bill,
we all agree that there are concerns about this new technology that is developing very, very rapidly, and that we can be leaders in showing that we can proceed cautiously with developing technologies that may cause harm and, in fact, have caused harm already to individuals in different parts of the country. I believe strongly that profits of major tech and security industries do not outweigh anyone's right to justice, to privacy, to due process, and civil liberties.
The council unanimously approving the measure, barring county departments from acquiring facial recognition technology or using such information. What it won't do,
it does not include anything in the private sector, nor does it include any other government within the borders of the King County.
And county agencies, including the sheriff's office, would still be able to use facial recognition evidence as long as they don't produce it themselves or ask for it. They can also still use it in connection with a federal program that searches for missing children. The new law would also allow people to sue if facial recognition technology is used in violation of the rules.
So they still can use facial recognition technology in certain cases.
In certain cases, again, primarily for the need to find missing and or trafficked children who are being sexually trafficked, that kind of thing. And then they left open the door with that Balducci amendment to if a county agency at some future point decides there's some legitimate reason for this use, as it they can come back and it requires the council to have that discussion and see if there's some reason to move forward with it. So it's kind of a protection. And then first, though, with that ban in place.
Mm-hmm. But it sounded like the technology is very effective. Well, it's bad at recognizing, accurately recognizing black people, women, et cetera. But there was no mention made of white people. So apparently it's pretty good at getting white people. So why not just use it for white people then?
Well, that, I think, opens up a whole nother discussion, and I don't think, I think you'd have discrimination arguments if you did that. I think one of the...
Well, you're not going to, I mean, I understand that that it can make mistakes, but you got to be good at your job as a cop, right? Just because you get a hit on facial recognition,
right.
That's a reason maybe to give the person a call or ask them some questions, not instantly clap them in handcuffs and, you know, take them to Guantanamo. So... and also, human witnesses make mistakes all the time, too.
So sure, absolutely. So what I'm just saying, you wouldn't be able to say you can just use facial recognition for white people and not for people of color. I think you'd get pushback from there. The other thing, though, that this does, as GeekWire was reporting, is that there'd been this kind of behind-the-scenes mailing list, emailing going on between police departments, police agencies, including several in the state, who, if they had bans or rules against this kind of technology, they'd send it over to another department that did not have that. Oh. And kind of look. Yeah. So sneaky. That was a really, really big concern. So it looks like they think this will avoid that kind of thing from going on, because it's basically the the effort to evade the need for a warrant is essentially what that did as a workaround, and again, get around your ban if you had one in place already as a local jurisdiction. So a lot of good safeguards here, and the ACLU seem to be happy with it. Now they want to push for the federal legislation that would do this.
Hannah Scott. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. On Monday, Memorial Day, we reintroduced you to what's become an annual tradition now, Taps Across America. Well, CBS's Steve Hartman is on the road with those who came together in unison to honor military service members.
From the rooftops of our biggest cities to the country roads, far from them. Monday at 3 p.m., Americans of all stripes and spots join together for what is now clearly an American tradition, the annual nationwide performance of Taps. Some players, like 70-year-old Michael Stanton of Dearborn, Michigan, learned trumpet just for this. Many others were returning professionals. And although abilities varied widely, the commitment was all first chair. 85-year-old Paul Freeberg of Surprise, Arizona, played in 100-degree heat. Others stood in pouring rain. It was like nothing could stop them from playing these pointed rounds. And as a result, Taps Across America was hard to escape. Whether you were at the racetrack in Louisville or a plain old parking lot outside Lowe's, you couldn't help but pay tribute. Whether you had your feet in the sand or your head in the clouds, you couldn't help but be reminded of the reason for the holiday. We'll never know exactly how many people took part, but based on the video submissions we received, it was certainly in the thousands, making this, again, one of the largest musical performances of all time.
And now we've created this awareness.
Yari Villanueva is with Taps for Veterans and my partner in the mission.
What is your hope for the future of this? I hope that this continues. It really is something that unifies us as Americans.
I noticed that too, as I watched the videos come in. Nothing else in recent memory has brought together such a diverse group of Americans. And as those 24 notes wove a binding thread through our fractured nation, the sound I heard was hope. Steve Hartman, CBS News, on the road.
From the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, here is G. Scott. G, I've been ignoring this story, and I probably shouldn't. I realize I'm probably ignoring it because I'm in the Seattle bubble. So that's why we need you, because you bring a unique cultural perspective. You are from Tacoma. So what is the Tacoma attitude towards this idea that Donald Trump is going to be miraculously restored to the presidency by some as yet unspecified process in the month of August?
It's scary and understandable that so many have been ignoring it, because that's what you're supposed to do. It's like, look, Donald Trump is not going to win again. He's not going to, be reinstated. The chances of him being reinstated would be the chances of Abraham Lincoln being reinstated. Like, it's not going to happen. However, what's scary, though? Here's what's scary. At a time when half of the Republican voters still believe that Donald Trump won the election, at a time where Trump's former national security advisor, Mike Flynn, this past weekend suggested of having that America should have a military coup. They don't even hide it anymore. Actually said that. I'm not giving an opinion. I'm not saying, telling you what somebody else said that they heard. I'm telling you with what is fact and what has been said. This person was the former national security advisor to the president of the United States.
But they don't have power anymore, right? Like, back when the coup or the insurrection happened on January 6th, there was a delay in calling in the National Guard. People were whole, you know, the vice president was begging the president, send somebody in. This is dangerous. Well, now President Biden's there. I mean, he could stop this from happening before it even started.
Sure. And then we now find out that Donald Trump will be a speaker down at the GOP convention down in North Carolina. That's going to be happening. So we can continue to, quote, ignore this problem that I feel, because I do really feel like our democracy right now is in peril. I do believe and have a feeling and understanding of what things and what the feeling was like when there was a civil war years ago that we've learned in our history books. And I used to always say to myself, I just don't understand how this happened. Like, that would never happen today. When I was learning those things in school, I can't tell you what you guys are thinking, but I'm telling you what I was thinking. I would always say, as I'm learning about these things, how in the world that would never happen today.
Right.
And now I get it. So, back to the question. Reinstatement? No, that's not going to happen. But the problem is that there's a lot of people in this country that actually believe that. They actually believe that there is a realm of possibility that he will be reinstated. And that makes me sad as well, that we have so many that do. And then the other ones that don't come out and speak against it, they're so afraid to say something because for some reason, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's speculation. But it's like Donald Trump has this power over them and they cannot speak out against that. And it blows my mind. I never knew that Donald Trump would have a stronghold on this party this way after leaving office.
Okay, so do you think the FBI approach should be to take any kind of opining on Facebook seriously? If somebody starts posting things,
yes,
like, and let's take over the Capitol on August, they should get a knock on the door?
They should for sure they should get a knock on the door. That's number one. And number two, you know what would be a good idea? What if there was a bipartisan commission on what happened on January 6th? What if that happened?
But that somebody would have to actually propose that, G, and then it'd have to be passed.
Bipartisanly, I mean.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. But, yeah. But you know what? You ask about my perspective. I want to tell you a little story real quick. Do you guys remember about 2-3 years ago? I think it was 2018. Do you guys remember when that person stole the plane from SeaTac? You guys remember that?
Of course. You were on the air. It was breaking news.
I was on the – that was the first time. Like, I'm like – and so I'd always – I'm not Colleen and all you guys. Like, what do you mean your adrenaline's rushing? Yo, when the plane was stolen, I got to find out firsthand how your adrenaline is going.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways – so that was going on. It was like, oh, man, somebody stole a plane. Like, who steals a plane? Anyways, that was on a Friday night. I think so. On Monday, my boss at the time brings me into the office with my co-host. And he sits there and he says, so I'm telling this story because, Dave, you reminded me of something. And he says to me, so, G, listen, when you're on the air during that time, at that time, I want to hear the urban perspective.
Oh, yeah.
I want to hear the urban perspective of when someone steals a plane. Mm-hmm. I have never been more perplexed in my life. Like, what is the urban perspective to someone stealing a plane? Let me answer that. It's the same perspective that everybody else in the world has. Oh, my goodness. Somebody just stole a plane. There it is.
There you go. Thank you. It's been something I've wondered about for years now.
My urban perspective?
Yeah, the urban perspective.
Thanks, Mark.
G will bring his urban perspective to the G. Ursula Show. 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. Hannah Scott joins us now. Seattle's mayor is pushing a plan to spend federal money to eliminate homelessness. And Hannah's going to tell us how that works. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. Yeah, this is a plan that was announced actually last week by the mayor and council members Teresa Mosqueda, also Lorena Gonzalez had a hand in coming up with this. And basically they're trying to come up with how they want to spend the American Rescue Plan dollars that came from the federal government. They will start debating this kind of like a budget at city council this week. And it's a big, big investment. Durkin says $49 million of the American Rescue Plan are proposed for addressing homelessness under the plan that they, she and the city council leaders teamed up on.
And with this investment, we expect to that more than 750 households will be moved to safer places, with 450 provided safer spaces and another 300 hopefully into affordable permanent homes.
In urging passage of the proposal yesterday, Durkin explained,
through the Seattle Rescue Plan, we've invested in a range of strategies to help our households who are experiencing all stages of homelessness. We're expanding our safe lots to help 25 households living in vehicles as they search for permanent living. We're increasing our rapid rehousing investments to help 185 families with rent subsidies for up to a year. We are reconnecting 250 individuals with family and friends who can offer a stable living environment, and will create at least 300 new housing units by leveraging additional state funding. This is in addition to the 1,000 units that will come online by 2022 for people experiencing homelessness.
So Democratic Senator David Frakt was also there and explained that the state did much of the work as well. First, though, I want to circle back to, as the was Mayor Durkin was going through many of those numbers, she says it might just sound like numbers to us, but here's the
reality. These investments, together with the investments we made in last year's budget and over time, represent the largest single investments across the spectrum of homelessness to try to make as big a difference as we can. As a city, our goal is simple, and that's to end a person's experience with homelessness.
But she stressed that Seattle cannot do this alone and needs to have both the support of the state and the federal government as far as dollars go, and says part of their state ask didn't come through this time.
Just for context, the state of California has spent over billions of dollars trying to solve the homelessness in its cities. It's bought hotels, it did Project Room Key, Project Home. They used a significant amount of their federal dollars. We asked for 10% of the federal dollars that came to the state of Washington to go to the most acute issue that all of the cities are dealing with, and we didn't get any. We're still going to be advocating for it. We're hoping that this proof of concept works, but I do hope that when the legislature reconvenes, that they look at this, because it was mayors from Spokane, Vancouver, Seattle, Bremerton, all of us signing letters saying, please help us. We need the state to step up. And so we need the state to use those resources to help in every city.
And Senator David Frakt, who was really pivotal in getting what was passed through the legislature this last session, said that they definitely will take another look at things. They hope in the next session. For this session, though, they really did put some major investments into the homelessness situation. Frakt says some of what the legislature did get in the budget on homelessness is.
One of the innovative things that we did was we created a $120 million rapid capital housing fund to allow communities to get the type of shelter they need immediately or more quickly, and to assist them, which is supposed to be separate and apart from the type of work that the Housing Trust Fund does, which is develop longer-term solutions over 3 or 4 years. So the idea here was we have the Housing Trust Fund, which is part of our long-term solution, and the Rapid Housing Acquisition Fund as well for cities like Seattle to apply into. And additionally, we set aside a specific amounts of money both for the Clay Apartments, for the Kiro Nursing Home project that is down in Africatown. And with Councilmember Lewis's leadership, we also set aside $2 million for additional tiny homes.
Now, Fox says the other big win was?
We passed something very important called an increase in our document recording fee, which is our main operational funding source for homelessness services around the state. King County gets a very significant proportion of that money. And importantly, we created a permanent fund for permanent supportive housing operations, as well as an emphasis on those who are unsheltered. We changed that bill around with the city's help, and we offered some amendments, and the focus is now on permanent supportive housing funding, as well as getting people inside who are unsheltered. And that was a very important bill, and it wasn't covered very much, but it's going to generate up to $290 million every 2 years just from that one source alone, dedicated for permanent supportive housing operations, which is vitally important to get people inside here in Seattle.
And that permanent supportive housing is absolutely essential. That's where you've got you get more of the people that you tend to see out on the street in perhaps in dealing with some mental health type of issues, things like that. They go into these permanent supportive housing situations where we've really not had enough capacity there for at ever any stage. So it's, I know it's a lot of numbers. It really is a nearly historic investment, though, from both the state and the plan that the mayor and city council leaders are pushing as far as the federal dollars go will expand out in many different directions. And there had already been some work done in their last city budget. So we asked at the press conference yesterday whether there would be a visible difference, right? I know you always want to know, yes. Dave, if the tents will go away and all of that. And, you know, it's going to take a while. That's what the mayor said. She said, you know, you're not going to see an immediate difference because the situation has gotten so much worse during the pandemic. There's the threat of the eviction moratoriums about to expire. I did ask the mayor, though, if because both the state and city eviction moratoriums are due to expire June 30th. I asked her if she planned to let hers expire, and she said she didn't commit to an answer. She said she hadn't decided yet, wanted to talk to the governor first, but that she did not feel that it was the right time to let that expire. So we'll have to see what happens there.
So it is a lot of numbers, but as you correctly observe, the one number everyone's interested in is the date by which the tents will be gone from the neighborhoods and from the parks. And I don't think anybody's expecting an immediate change. People have given up on that. They would just like some sort of commitment, because without that, I don't think anybody has confidence that this plan will be any more successful than the other, dozen plans that we've had over the past.
Right. And I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, we're all just, it sounds like more dollars being thrown at the situation. What I can tell you, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, is that there was a variety of big investments that both went into the homeless from the state level that you just heard Senator Frog talk about. And at the same time, as he pointed out yesterday, really nearly, I believe actually historic investment in behavioral health. And they're also the healthcare authority, and I'll talk to you more about this next week, is tasked with kind of being the hub, right? So that everyone is communicating, all the agencies in the state are communicating at the city level, at the county level, and everyone's working kind of in concert to address these things. That's the big idea that came out of the legislative session. And I am actually quite hopeful that this will make a difference. It may not be tomorrow, but I would expect to see something significantly different in the next year or so. And that would start to see fewer people out in those tents. It's going to take, though, probably a couple of years, I think, before we see all the tents gone.
Well, that's reassuring. Coming from you, as somebody who's covered the story for a long time and understands the players and is also kind of a cynic about these things, the fact that you see some hope there, I think will give comfort to a lot of people. So
I definitely see the hope, and I'll definitely be on top of all these agencies throughout to make sure that it's going the way it's supposed to.
All right, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.